And sorry? And the entropy there is, yes, there is. So it's possible to study quantities like entanglement entropy and so on using also this kind of these areas and so on. Yeah. Yeah, there are some connections there, but this will be somehow orthogonal. But in particular, we will see how to compute these guys using EDS-CFT. There is a dictionary, a prescription, and that prescription is very similar to the one that you would use to compute entanglement entropy. When you fix some region, you integrate out over what's left, then there's also a contour which separates this region, say imagine if you are in two dimensions, and then the prescription, it's again an observable that depends on a contour and so on, and many of the things go up. But okay, that's beyond the scope of what we are going to do. So let's just make a brief summary of what we have done. Before making a brief summary, let me correct something which I think I said, which was not entirely correct. I'm not sure if I said it, but I thought I did, so let me correct it if I did. So what we said was that when we integrate over these links, we needed to have one plaquette. Whenever we have a link, the link cannot be alone, because the integral over the link is zero. So we needed to glue, to put there a plaquette. And when we put that plaquette, there are some other link which is not matched, so we need to put another one, and so on, and at the end of the day, we needed a surface bounding the curve, right? This was the idea. But I wrote something, I think, like this. I had the boundary, and I said, now I must have this plaquette, because I have these edges here. But not entirely. I could have, for example, this could go up, and the surface could close later. I must have anything with plaquettes, provided at the end of the day, I get a surface bounding that curve. It's not important to go to flatten it close to the boundary. I could go up a lot and then stop closing it after. What matters is that each link is never left alone. Okay? Yes?
Isn't that not a minimal surface?
Right, it will not be minimal, but you would never know, because imagine here it starts going up, then down, and so on. It's saying if it's minimal or not, it's not something local, it's global. Right? Because it can be flat like this, but then here the contour can start going up a lot. If you are looking here, you might think that it's good to be flat. But if you would have the full picture, you would know that it's better to start going up to get a minimal surface. Right? So yeah, so minimal surfaces is something global. I tell you a contour, and it's in principle a very non-local thing to find. I have to find a surface which minimizes this. So it's, yeah. The surface needs to know what is going to happen later to choose the minimal shape. Okay, very good. Is this clear? Yeah? Okay, so what have we seen so far? We have defined these Wilson loops in QED. And in QED, we can compute them perturbatively. We have zero loops, one loop, two loops, dot, dot, dot. Because QED is free, I mean, this is nothing but the square of this guy, and so on, so it exponentiates, and this is the exact result. It's just exponential of the one loop diagram. And for the rectangle, so for a rectangle, we computed and we read off the interaction between two electrons, and we got that it was just a Coulomb potential. For QCD, the situation is tougher. For QCD, the one loop, up to one loop, it's still the same. But then at higher loops, it's no longer a free theory. The gluons self-interact. These diagrams here, I did not draw the one that they cross, because in the planar limit, they cannot cross. It must be planar. There are three vertices, and so on. And this is hard, as I told you. At strong coupling, we estimated what this is, and we saw that it obeys the so-called area law. It's exponential of minus and string tension times the area, the minimal area, which will depend on the contour that we choose. And in particular, at strong coupling, the minimal area of the rectangle, as we said, was just T times R, and this led to a linear potential V of R. So V of R, then we saw what could this string tension be at weak coupling by using the normalization. So at the end of the day, the picture is that for the Wilson loop, for the rectangle, it's always e to the minus t times a linear potential, where this k square, this string tension, varies in this way, and we study the weak and the strong coupling behavior of this guy. Okay, very good. Any questions? Okay. So, what to do next? If you want to study quantum field theories, well, let's be a bit more broad now than just Wilson loops. Suppose you are in this situation, okay? You would very much like to study this stuff exactly, for example. You would like to do exact computations in QCD, you would like to compute the mass of the globules exactly, and so on. But okay, I mean, we more or less covered all the tools that are available, and we don't know how to do it. Okay, so we need to find toy models to get some experience, to learn more, and then hopefully to come back to QCD. Okay? So, from today till the end of the lectures, that is today and tomorrow, we will study a toy model, a simplified gauge theory, which is called N equals 4 supernumeral. Okay, so the motivation is, so, to make progress, it seems that to make progress, or to make analytic progress, we need some toy models. Now, as I said, so what are the possibilities for this toy model? Okay. So first, okay, well, let's first be, let's see. Okay. So, the first thing that we might expect is that probably n going to infinity helps. Okay? Probably n goes to infinity helps because we have only planar diagrams. We know that when n is very large, our expansion becomes a string theory. Our theory is described by a string theory. Because in this limit, then, we should have a two-dimensional description. Because we know that there must be a string description of our theory. And two dimensions is easier than four dimensions. Much easier to study models in two dimensions than in four. So the guiding principle to find this toy model could be, okay, let's study QCD using the string description of QCD. But there is a small problem, which is that we don't know what the string description of QCD is. So we need to find theories for which this string description has been worked out, where we have something more rigorous, and where we know this is the string theory that should describe holographically or gauge theory. Okay? So, for some typically supersymmetric theories, we know the two-dimensional description. And of course that helps. If you want to feel some formalism, it's good to know what it is. For example, n equals 4 super young mules is dual to strings in ADS 5. Okay, and that's 5. DS 5 for us will not play any role. Okay? It's possible to argue for this correspondence. And this is what John did to explain you how this ADS breakdowns emerge and so on. I must say that there are some drawbacks in doing this, because this toy model is very nice because it's a four-dimensional gauge theory. So this guy is a four-dimensional gauge theory, of course. That's cool. But many properties of QCD doesn't have. It doesn't have confinements and so on, for example. So there is another line that we could try to follow, which is, let's try to find models which still have this dimensional mass transmutation, which still have confinements and so on. But then typically it's hard to find exactly solvable models that you can compute stuff exactly. Then you go to the realm of two-dimensional models. That often helps. So there are two-dimensional models which have many of these features of QCD, that you generate a dimension full quantity, like this string tension, starting from dimensionless quantities, and which have the same kind of qualitative features as QCD. So that's a very interesting direction. I was going to describe it briefly, but I think I'll rather... Let's rather attack this theory. So n equals to 4 super young mules is also known as... I heard at least two people advertise it as the harmonic oscillator of gauge theories. This is how I also like to think about it. Like the harmonic oscillator of gauge theories. And our hope is that this is the first one to understand. If we understand this guy completely, then we can start putting a dagger a square into our harmonic oscillator and start constructing more complicated gauge theories. Why do we say that it's the harmonic oscillator of gauge theories? Because the results that we get when we study n equals 4 super young mules turn out to be surprisingly simple. And much simpler than the intermediate computations, by the way, and by some reason that people don't understand yet. And because there is a theory with lots of symmetry. As John told you, it's a theory with more symmetry that you can have in four dimensions. And finally, because it's something very important, that strings in ADS5-4-5, these are described by a two-dimensional sigma model, right? It's a two-dimensional field theory. which is integrable. And this was really understanding that there is this hidden symmetry of n equals 4 super young mules. The fact that you have a model which is exactly solvable, which is dual to it, led to the belief that n equals 4 should be exactly solvable. We should be able to compute stuff at any value of the coupling, whatever observable we want to choose, provided we are smart enough. The trick is often to map this to a two-dimensional problem, but then the model that we get turns out to be exactly solvable. Okay, I'm not sure how much should I motivate n equals 4, because I think that you heard Freddy told you a bit about n equals 4 as a low energy limit of 10-dimensional n equals 1. And John probably told you a bit about n equals 4, the symmetries of n equals 4, and so on, right? During the previous week. Okay, good. So, before defining even what are these Wilson loops in n equals 4, because we defined the Wilson loops in pure glue, we defined the Wilson loops in QED, in n equals 4 there is a slight generalization of the Wilson loop. Let's postpone for now the definition, and let me tell you how the dictionary tells you how to compute them. Right? So can you give me an example of something that you know how to compute using ADS-CFT? Some correlation function, for example. What's the prescription? No? Last week?
You get the propagator from one point to another point in the boundary.
Right. So you have the boundary-to-boundary propagator, for example, right? That goes in ADS. So what we do typically for correlation functions is, so ADS, we can think the ADS metric, it's very useful to write it ADS as something like dz square plus dxi square over z square. And the boundary of ADS corresponds to z going to 0. So we can think that this is z, this is the boundary, so this stuff here is our axis. And then, as Anton was saying, what we typically do to compute correlation functions, we put a source here, we put a source here, and then it propagates in ADS from one point to the other, and this, according to the dictionary, tells you what is the correlation function between a point at some position x and a point at some position y. Okay? And this, as Anton was saying, is a boundary-to-boundary propagation. This you have seen, right? By the way, there was a small subtlety that they were not exactly going to the boundary, right? You remember that you had to put them going slightly away, some epsilon away from the boundary, to regulate them a bit. Because basically, you have this huge rep factor, so it costs a lot to go to the boundary, so it's better to put them slightly away, to regulate a bit to go away from the boundary. So given this picture, there are not many things that you could try to draw. If you would like now to come up, so try to use your imagination and see what would be the prescription for computing Wilson loops at strong coupling when the ADS description is is valid. What kind of picture could you imagine the computer will send? So this is the boundary. So this is the boundary, this plane. So this is where the four-dimensional CFT lives. So we put there 2 points, we compute this process in ADS, and we get a two-point function. Now suppose you want the wheel sample. I think there is only one conceivable thing that you could do, actually. Well, what would you propose?
Is this on the loop?
Yeah, that's really not what else could it be. Right? The only thing that is for the loop, for wheels and loops, the picture, the only reasonable thing that you can come up with, and then you can try to argue and check that it is true, is the following. You have here the space where your CFT lives, and here is the loop that you want to study. Okay, so we want to study this wheels and loops. And the prescription tells me, okay, find the minimal surface that ends on this Wilson loop. It's a surface which ends on this Wilson loop. It stretches inside ADS because of this Z factor. So this is like a wind that pushes it inside ADS. It's really a gravitational force that pushes it inside ADS. It doesn't like to be close to the boundary because of this huge 1 over Z factor. So it goes inside ADS. And then it closes. This is a minimal surface. In ADS. Okay. And this Wilson loop is roughly exponential of minus. So of course we are computing now at strong coupling. Like what we did for the lattice. But this is how ADS CFT proposes. It tells us that it should be e to the minus square root of lambda over 2 pi times the area of this surface. Well, we can try to check it. It's the simplest in this proposal. Now, this cannot be right as it is. Or, it's not that it cannot be right. It looks a bit suspicious. It might look a bit suspicious to you. Because we are going up to the boundary, I'm drawing. But we know that at least for correlation functions, we need to space an epsilon away from the boundary. So this area will be divergent. Because this region of the area where we are approaching a lot the boundary, this strip here, will have infinite area. Because of this 1 over z factor. So this strip here contains infinite area. But okay, this is a divergence, which is proportional to the length of this Wilson loop, and the interpretation of this is clear. It is just mass normalization. Okay, it's a divergence which will be proportional to the length of the loop, times this thickness here, say this epsilon, and this we interpret as mass normalization. So we subtract it out. Okay? So this divergent part is just mass normalization. As we saw before. And the neat way of subtracting it, so to subtract the divergence, what the prescription tells us to do is the following. By the way, you will see this in more detail this afternoon after we prepare the tutorial about precisely studying these minimal surfaces in ADS, so we will be able to play with it. So a neat way of subtracting these divergences we can do the following. We consider two surfaces actually. One, so there is your contour here and here is your minimal surface, and let's consider another surface which starts at this base C and just goes up, just a cylinder, an infinite cylinder. And then, which has the same, the same shape here, which is here, and it just goes on forever. When z is becoming very large, it becomes very small, so this area is convergent. It's then it's not a problem that it continues forever. That part doesn't cost in infinite area. What costs very lots of energy is goes to the boundary. And then the precise prescription is the following. The Wilson loop is E to the minus, so let's call this surface sigma naught. It's a very simple surface. It ends on the boundary z equal to 0 and just stretches up. Let's call this surface sigma. And then we get e to the minus square root lambda over 2 pi area of the minimal surface, of the surface which solves the equations of motion, which extremizes this the soap film, if you want, minus, it's really the soap film, area of this surface sigma. Okay, good. So this is what the CFT. This was proposed by Juan Maldacena in 98, 1 year after proposing the correspondence. He proposed this formula, this way of computing Wilson loops at strong coupling using EDS-CFT. And it's very cute that it realizes somehow the idea, the intuition that we have for lattice QCD. But the intuition for lattice QCD was not really so correct, because we saw that it was not really, it did not really have a good continuum limit. Things were a bit shaky there, remember, because we had to take this lattice space to be very large and so on. And indeed, in n equals 4 supreme mills, we see that the correct thing to do is not exactly what we were saying, but instead, you also should compute a minimal surface, but in one higher dimension. That's cool. It's again a geometrical thing, again a minimal surface, but it doesn't live just on Minkowski. If there is one more dimension, and it stretches also in this direction. And this turns out to be indeed the correct prescription. Okay, so what should I... So let me see, what am I asking in this tutorial? So I write the metric, then we wrote that this is the prescription, then what is the area? You know that... How do you compute the area of a surface? If I tell you the shape of the surface, what do you do? Where do you plug to get the area? Suppose I give you the shape. Sorry? Which quantity do you know in string theory which precisely measures the area of the string surface?
Action.
The action. The action of the string, the Nambu-Goto action, right? Was exactly this. We said that for a particle we minimize the length. What was the action for the string? It was the area of the tube, right? That was precisely how it was motivated. So, okay, so what we should do is solve the equation of motion, plug it into Nambu-Goto. Plug this stuff into Nambu-Goto and get the result. Then I ask you to explain why the area of this guy is indeed the length over epsilon. This is something which is what we understand as massing normalization. So we will see that the area of this guy is very simple to compute. Then we study a straight line. So let me make a few comments because I don't want you to be stuck on the straight line. What would be the surface that ends on an infinite straight line? So let's say what is the straight line. So for a straight line, I have some infinite line, and I want to consider my Wilson loop associated to this line. What would be the minimal surface that stretches inside ADS and ends on this minimal line? You could solve equations of motion and so on, but it's a bit pathetic for this. It's because symmetry alone tells you that there's only one thing that it could be. What could it be? It starts going up, what could it do? This surface. What? We want the minimal surface. It ends on this line and goes up. Let's draw the beginning. It's infinite line. An infinite line. Sorry? Yeah, it's an infinite plane. What could it be? How could it decide? By symmetry, it can only be an infinite plane. So it just goes up. This is the minimal surface. But then what's the difference between this guy and this guy? They are the same. So the Wilson loop for a straight line is equal to 1. Okay? This was a loop that I didn't define yet very rigorously, what they are in n equals 4, but for the Wilson line, they are 1. Suppose I now tell you to compute what the Wilson loop for a circle is. How would you do? For some reason, I'm telling you about the circle after telling you about the line. Because a line and a circle are not that different. What's the relation between a line and a circle? How do you get one from the other?
Complexify.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but there is another way. When you have a conformal theory, a conformal transformation, a special conformal transformation, maps a line to a circle. If you have a line, if you do an inversion, it's mapped to a circle, right? So using conformal symmetry, we can map this surface to the surface that ends on the circle. In particular, the boundary has conformal symmetry, so it contains special conformal transformation, invariance, and so on. In the bulk, for the full ADS, those symmetries are isometries of the background. So there is an isometry of the background that sends x to some x tilde, z to some z tilde, leaving the metric invariant, such that when z is equal to 0, it reduces to the usual conformal transformation. And using that isometry, you map this surface to the surface of the circle, then you compute the area. So because of this trick, no equation to solve. Okay? This is the subject of the homework. So the idea is that now we can apply a conformal transformation, which in the bulk corresponds to an isometry, and end up with a surface which ends on a circle. And now it is a non-trivial surface which ends on a circle. And if you compute this, you get that the Wilson loop for the circle is equal, x strong coupling, to exponential of square root of 1. Okay, this is another nice shape that you can consider the circle. So we did a line, the circle. The other shape that it's nice to do is the rectangle. The rectangle is also cool. It's also very simple. And for the rectangle, we get something nice, which is that the expectation of the Wilson loop for the rectangle is e to the minus t v of r, where v of r is equal to minus, for this guy you need to solve the equation of motion. Life can't be perfect forever, right? For two straight lines, there is no trick. Do mapping it from something, you need just to solve the minimal surface. Square root of 2, gamma function of 1 quarter to the power 4, square root of lambda, of 2 coupling, and then 1 over r. Okay? Very neat, not confining. It doesn't have the n equals 4 is not confining, and we don't get some BS results telling us that it confines. It really goes like 1 over r. Aren't you a bit suspicious? Aren't you surprised that it goes as 1 over r given the setup? So I'm telling you that you have to compute the area of a rectangle. You are putting the rectangle bigger and bigger, and the potential is not increasing linearly. How come? Because, I mean, the fact that it goes linearly before was just, I mean, the area, you increase the rectangle, the area increases. Linearly, of course. But now I'm telling you, okay, it's roughly the same. I'm telling you, do more or less the same. Consider, again, the ADS surface. Consider your big rectangle. Now you have some minimal surface here. And I'm telling you that if you increase this distance r, the area is not increasing linearly. Why? How could it be?
Conformal invariant there.
Sorry?
We are scale invariant from the boundary.
Very good. So from the boundary point of view, as Joel is saying, we are scale invariant. It should be 1 over r. Just conformal symmetry tells you that the potential should be 1 over r. Like it is, conformal invariant. Okay, but from the point of view of the boundary, Joel, what would you say? Yeah, from the boundary you are right. It should be. But what's going on then? How come? You are putting a bigger and bigger rectangle and the area is not growing linearly.
Right.
What happened? Yes?
It's from the matrix.
It's from the matrix.
I think if you make it wider, the hemisphere thing will go higher, but it has a smaller contribution.
Absolutely, because the area, this ds square, was dz square plus dx square over z square. So one way of thinking of this as John probably drew, was to think that this is like foliations of Minkowski, right, which are becoming smaller and smaller. So at given z, this is like an overall scale, it's very big. And then there was this picture, I'm sure that... Did he draw this picture?
Yeah.
With Minkowski becoming smaller and smaller. So what does it mean for us? It means that the string starts here. Then it goes up, now it's at the peak z. Now the line element here is much smaller, it's weighted by a smaller z, so it goes like a highway, almost doesn't cross the area, and then goes down again. So the fact that the string can go to bigger z's, then there is this ref factor that helps it suppress, and then it costs much less to go up there, and then it comes back again. So it's not just, if you stretch a lot, it goes, it probes the regions of z which don't suppress the area, and therefore you don't get a growing behavior. So the string likes it. The string can go up a lot, it moves just a little here, and then it goes down again. Roughly that's the picture. Why? It is just not growing linearly with R. Okay, very good. This was just introduction to the tutorial. We will have time to do it at length in the afternoon. Yes?
You probably said this before, but minimal. When you say minimal surface, are you saying like minimal area or something?
Minimal surface, after the surface that solves the equation of motion with those boundary conditions. Okay, so you need to find a surface which ends on this contour and solve the equation of motion. Is it the minimal? Is it the surface with less area? No, it's not. It's because as usual it's a saddle point. Whenever you have actions and you minimize, we always say minimize, but it always means a saddle point, typically. And there are no minimas. There are no minima, as you know, surface analysis, right? There is always saddle points. Minima don't exist, as I told you at the very beginning. Such thing doesn't exist. And in particular, this guy, the orange guy, the area of the orange guy is always smaller than the area of the white guy. Because it's going just north. The area of this orange is always smaller than the area of the white. Yes.
So can you say again what the orange area is?
Why it is what?
What it is. What it is.
What it is?
Yeah, sigma naught.
Sigma naught is the surface which ends on this curve. And then just moves up at the same x as the curve, but with z changing.
So it's infinitely long.
It's infinitely long. It's an infinitely long cylinder, but the area is finite. Because you are integrating, so this orange one, sigma naught, is given by, this is asked explicitly in the exercise. You should just plug this infinite surface into the Nambu-Goh collection and check that the area is finite. So you will see it in the afternoon. But sigma naught, so you have z and x, I. And what are they? They are given by z and x, I of t, where this is what parameterizes the contour, the curve c. Okay? So this sigma naught is parameterized by two parameters, z and t. So as you change t, you go around. As you change z, you go up and down. Okay? So z moves you here, and t moves you here. And this parameterizes the surface, and you can plug this into Nambu-Goh and see that it's exact. Okay. Very good. So, I told you what the prescription is for computing minimal surfaces. For computing this Wilson loops, you should compute minimal surfaces in Andesitter, and this is what he will do in the afternoon. And tomorrow, before the lecture, when the lecture starts, I can start by answering all your questions about the tutorial. So, it's on the long side, the tutorial today. Okay, good. So, what do we really, really need to keep out of this blackboard? Well, first I would like you to keep the idea, to know that Wilson loops can be computed holographically and that they have this nice geometrical meaning. Some minimal surface, and it's again a geometrical problem with the difference that it's a minimal surface living in one more dimension. This is the thing number zero. The other thing that I want you to keep in mind is that for the circle, the prediction of just this geometrical problem is e to the square root of 1. Okay? So let's keep this in cache, and we'll come back to this later. Okay. So these two things. Wilson loops in ADS-CFT are just minimal surfaces, and this you will see how it works in detail in the afternoon. And the second thing, for the circle, the prediction from this analysis tells you that you should find e to the square root of lambda when lambda is large. Okay, very good. And you have to keep it in cache, this comment, this circle stuff, till tomorrow. We will come back to this tomorrow. Okay, very good. So, any question here? Most likely this is the only at SFT that I will do. I think now I'll go back to field theory, and we will come back to the SFT only at the very, very end. So is there any question about this? Do you want to know something more? If I know.
Is it clear why it's better than lambda?
Good. So, why do we put here, why is the square root of lambda sitting here, square root of lambda being the twist coupling? What would you normally put, multiplying the number with attraction? Sorry?
Tension.
Yeah? And the tension according to the SFT is exactly the square root of lambda. This was the dictionary, right? As we saw, for example, when we did this large N. Even with this large N analysis, remember the twist coupling was related to the fluctuations of the surface. And N was related to opening holes, to considering loops. So G string, the G and mu was the related to the string coupling, and the toothed coupling was related to the string tension. Right? So even if we take only planar diagram, we still have toothed coupling, we still have string tension. And therefore the string tension is related to the toothed coupling. Yeah? It's clear? Fix 1 over N. You still have a function of lambda to compute. You see some O-planar diagrams. The surface still oscillates, more. It just doesn't create holes or stuff, but it still oscillates and vibrates and so on. And those vibrations are suppressed by square root of lambda. Okay. So, let's try... okay. So let's look for some more finite Wilson loops. That is, we have our Wilson loop, and we saw that there is a divergence. It's not that it matters much because it's physical, but there was a divergence when these two points approached each other. Right? Here, when these points are approaching each other, we have that we have this x dot of t1 dot x dot of t2 over the distance, and the distance goes to 0, so this guy goes to 0, so it gives a divergence. So it goes to 0 quadratically, so you integrate, so this gives a divergence which is of which is 1 over a, right? It's an integral of a quadratic divergence. And, okay, so this is divergent. It's a physical divergence, as we saw. But still, okay. Still, we might think, is it possible to construct something which is a bit more finite, and typically when we find some well-defined finite quantity, it's very rare that it doesn't have nice applications. So it's typically a good guiding principle to find things which are well-defined. Yeah? So, even though it's physical, let's try to think, how could we try to construct something which is a bit better than this, a bit more finite? So, given that this is the form of the divergence, can someone propose something that could be more finite, naively, than this?
Log of A.
Log of A. No, of course, yeah, log of A is more finite. No, I mean, how could you... Suppose I want to tell you that some loops, some contours, are more finite than others. Why? So the total divergence, this is what happens when it approaches this point, and then you integrate this point. So it goes like the length of the loop over it. Right? So we want to construct loops which are more finite. What do you propose? When is this not divergent?
When it's straight line.
Yeah, but you shouldn't, you of course shouldn't. Yeah, you are doing a, yeah. Eduard is doing a project on precisely this one.
Exactly.
Send the length of the loop to zero as well.
Yeah, if you send the length of the loop to zero as well, then it's not a loop.
Then it's a like a
some like some string and you let it go and that's not fine. But there's another nice way of sending the length to zero, which is not what I'm saying. What is it? How do you send a length of something to zero still keeping something interesting? You make it null. Right? So if you have 2 points which are null separated, their distance is zero. But it's still something cool. Still some distance for the eye. So the idea is that if this guy, if you have, consider this is a null segment, then this guy is finite. More than finite. It's actually zero. Because x dot dot x dot is just zero. X dot square is the velocity is null, so it's zero. On this contour, x dot of t dot x dot of t prime, if this is point x of t and this x of t prime, is equal to zero. It's a straight line, they are both the same, and they are a null vector, so this, they are both the same, so let's call it k dot k, and this is equal to zero because the segment is null. Okay, it's kind of a cool idea. So if you have no lines, it will not describe a static quark, it will describe quarks moving at the speed of light. And you could imagine having two lines and then some flaps between these quarks moving at the speed of light. That's neat. That's one possibility. But this is not a Wilson loop, this is a Wilson segment. So what do you propose?
Infinite
null lines, good idea, yeah. Infinite null line, yeah. Then we can compute the Wilson loop, the result is one. Okay, then we can move to another research topic. Yes?
You can have another polyline.
Very good. Let's make a polygon. Okay? So let's make a null polygon. Okay, this is a neat idea. So the edges here, there is a subtlety. If no one complains, I'm going to move on until I will discuss it, because I'm lying. This is not yet perfectly finite, but almost. But if you don't see why, you will have to wait a bit like a little. Let's call this distance here k1. Let's call this distance here k2, let's call this distance k3, etc. Till this distance here, which is kn, where n is the number of edges of my polygon.
Peter.
Yes?
Doesn't it make sense to speak of the length a along a null line?
No, it doesn't. No. The null line is null, it has length 0. Yeah.
Okay.
It doesn't. But k makes sense, it's a null vector, I mean, it's okay. Right? K squared is zero. Right? It's null. So, all these k's, they are null segments, so for any I, ki squared is equal to zero. Yes?
I don't understand how do we draw null lines in one direction. Null lines.
No, one goes to the past, the other to the future, the other to the past, the other to the future. This is three-dimensional. You can even do... The signature doesn't need to be 3-1. 3 times 3-1 space. You can even do 2-2 signature. Yeah, do that. You can do complex. It can be a complex curve. Then you don't even need to excite time. It can be null using complex math. Yeah, doesn't matter.
The velocity doesn't seem to be well-defined at the vertices where it changes.
Okay, very good. So that's related to the subtlety. I'll come back to that later. That's very good. So we better think a bit more carefully about the cusps, because the fact that you have these small peaks might be dangerous, and indeed, we will see that it is slightly dangerous. But let's come back to that a bit later. But again, we know that this stuff here is finite. It's actually zero, as we saw. And then, this stuff here, for example, they are very far away, this is finite. And interesting. Not zero, but interesting. Okay, good. So this tells you, this gives you an object, a Wilson loop, which is not just function of an arbitrary, it's not function of an arbitrary contour, it's function of a sequence of vectors, k1, k2, kn, where, by the way, the sum of k's is equal to zero, and each k is null. What other, again, not for Eduardo and Tian Heng, of course, but what other object did you encounter during this year, which is a function of n k's which are null? What kind of other quantity in physics are we used? You should have thought this. Not for you. And then, there's another object that we are very used in physics. So, an object which asks for the same data. Is a scattering amplitude. A scattering amplitude, you scatter particles with momenta k1 up to kn. Let me put here the same data with a star because it's not exactly correct. I'm going to specify why in a minute. But an amplitude, if it's a non-shell amplitude, so let's say a scattering amplitude of gluons. If they are gluons, then again, they are massless. K squared is zero. The sum of k's is zero. Why? Conservation of momentum for the scattering amplitude. And here in the polygon, it's just because the polygon is closed, as a chain was saying. So, sum of ki is equal to zero. This is nothing but conservation of momentum. Okay. Now this is cool. You have two objects, naively very different. And now what has been discovered, maybe 1 or 2 years ago, is that these objects are the same. In n equals 4 superimages. And this is absolutely remarkable, and no one would have guessed, I think, or it would be very hard to guess without ADS-CFT, which brought lots of intuition for why this is true, but I don't have time to discuss this. So a scattering amplitude, where you have your particles, say how many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You have your 8 particles with k1, k2, up to kn, your gluons. Okay? This guy is equal to this Wilson loop. Now, it's not exactly, I cannot be this naive, because this guy is not uniquely specified by k's. You cannot tell when someone asks you for, some experimentalist asks you, what's your prediction for the scattering amplitude of 8 gluons, he doesn't just tell you the moment of the gluons. What else do you need to know? Ellipses, right? So, you also need to know the ellipses. So, this same data, this is for the simplest, this works for the simplest, this duality as I'm discussing now, this works for the simplest choice ability. And by simplest, you can ask me later, or you can ask Trevor, Joel, many people who are doing projects on scattering amplitudes, happy, many people. So for the simplest choice abilities. Okay? And that's the so-called MHV amplitudes. This is something extremely remarkable that was found in 2007, and which is a very active field of research. More than that, recently, in particular by Dave Skinner and Wissir at Perimeter and other people, it was understood how to make this equal sign perfect, not only for the simplest choice of elliptics, but for all possible amplitudes. Okay, so right now, there exists a duality. So let me write it here. So there exists a duality between any scattering amplitude, which seems to be the same as some supersymmetry, some Suzy loops. If you have usual loops, you have just usual ellipticities. If you have these super loops, you can have any possible scattering amplitude. And this is extremely recently. I mean, last week there was a paper on this. I mean, it's something which is less than 1 year old. It's a couple of months old. It's from December or January or something like this. Okay? So we are reaching the boundary of human knowledge. Very cool. Now, and now let's come to the subtlety. So I should tell you, I wanted to tell you that there is this very important, but also very important motivation for studying loops and loops. And the subtlety is that these guys, the Wilson loops, still have UV divergences. Where are the divergences of this diagram? They still have divergences. It's not true what I said, that this guy, all the diagrams now are finite. There are some diagrams which are still divergent. Which ones? How can you imagine something there giving something divergent? Again, not someone working on scattering amplitudes. Unless you didn't, you were not explicitly taught that. How could this guy be divergent? What kind of, so this guy is zero. This one is finite, they are very far away. What could be divergent? No. Okay, the area would be UV, yeah, but no. That's not UV, that would be some infrared stuff, a very big area. How can you have a short distance singularity? Yes.
So the points on
the... These points, yeah.
Yeah.
What could happen? If it's related to these points, exactly, what could happen?
So, I guess you have one of those points.
Very good. So we see that the divergence is proportional to the inner product of the two velocities, right? So the velocities of this point, they are always the same, and they converge to the same point. And that point is zero. But here and here on these two curves, the velocities are different. So the points are approaching, and the velocities are not becoming the same. They are constant and different on both sides. But the distance is going to zero. So we have this velocity is not the velocity from the left and the velocity from the right are not the same. Nothing to do, they are something, there's some angle. But the distance is going to zero. So this diagram here are still divergent. Okay? Because these diagrams, they are proportional to the velocity from the left dot the velocity approaching from the right over epsilon squared. And these guys are divergent. So, but these are, on the other hand, these divergences are very these divergences are very localized at the cusps. It's something that only happens close to each cusp. I can ignore the rest of the polygon and focus on this cusp and see what are the divergences that arise close to each cusp. Okay? So if you want, it's something local, contrary to the other one, which is proportional to the length of the loop. This is something that if you have 10 cusps, you have just 10 divergences at each of the cusps. And they are very local. They don't care about the total shape of the polygon and so on. They just care about the angle of the cusp, if you want. And therefore, they are even more boring than the other ones, even more understood, and they are actually very well studied because they also appear in many other contexts. And therefore, these divergences are just given by some sum, roughly, from I equal 1 up to n, of some function, of some cutoff, and some angle of the cusp I, roughly. And these are very well understood. So people know what is their general structure for any coupling and so on. So these are very well understood. Okay? So again, the point is that they are interesting, these guys, they are interesting, of course, but very local. On the other hand, scattering amplitudes also have divergences. So it better be, otherwise I cannot have an equal sign where one side diverges and the other is fine. That would be bad for my conjecture. And they have divergences which are infrared divergences, because you are scattering massless particles. So when you are scattering massless particles, nothing forbids you from creating many particles in the outer space, so there are infrared divergences. Okay? Hold on. Did someone did you hear about infrared divergences in any of the courses? Yes? They are due to the fact that in a conformal theory, particles are never actually free, and the interactions fill the full space. There are divergences proportional to the volume. And indeed, those infrared divergences, these guys, they are dual. These UV divergences of loops are dual to the infrared divergences of scattering amplitudes, which are also very localized processes. If you have a scattering amplitude and you have two lines, these are divergences from this kind of diagram. Okay? And you can indeed see that the structure of divergences coming from loops and from amplitudes are exactly the same. Again, they are also very well studied because people need them for accelerators. And you can really see that the structure of divergences coming from summing all these Wilson loops here and summing all these soft diagrams here, they can be met from one another, and this is one evidence for this conjecture. And then you can check the conjecture by computing explicitly stuff. Okay, very good. For example, if you want to see how this works, if you have a one loop amplitude, how it is the same divergence as the one loop Wilson loop, you can ask Jen Heim. She studied it. Okay, very cool. Very good, very good. Okay, so I wanted to tell something about a very, very recent research development, which is something which, for example, I am working on. Some more people, Freddy and Dave and Amit and other people at Perimeter are trying to pursue, and which is an interesting line of research right now. So there is a big motivation for trying to compute these Wilson loops, in particular because they are dual to scattering amplitudes. So, and technically Wilson loops typically are easier to compute than scattering amplitudes. I don't know if you realize from these lectures, but I mean, Wilson loops are relatively simple to compute, you see. You just put a propagate and integrate over the position and so on. Scattering amplitudes, not so trivial. Did you compute scattering one loop scattering amplitudes, for example? You probably computed only three level, right? Like electron-electron going to like diffusion of two electrons and so on, right? This is the kind of stuff that you did. And you did probably three level, yeah? And it was tough already, right? And I imagine what loops and so on. Whereas here, we did the one loop Wilson loop, I mean, in like half minute, right? So Wilson loops are technically, typically much simpler than scattering amplitudes, yes?
Are these Wilson equivalent dual to the full scattering amplitude, or just at three level? Or?
No, these are dual to the full scattering amplitude. You do all possible loops on one side, all possible loops on the other side, and they are the same. So, okay, this will give a set of lectures. Actually, at some point I thought I would give you just lectures on this. Then I decided not to, but next year probably I will. You can watch on Pista. By the way, I should say that we are studying n equals 4th perennial, which is an exactly solvable theory. And I'm basically not mentioning at all one of the most important developments in n equals 4 supremial, which is the study of other observables, which are not Wilson modes, but rather correlation functions of usual operators. That's the thing that comes to mind when you study four-dimensional gauged conformal field theory. The first thing that comes to mind is two-point function. It's not some Wilson mode. And there is a huge development. This subject is very well understood. There is remarkable progress in understanding the spectrum and the two-point functions of operators in n equals 4. And that was basically what I covered last year, so you can watch it also. And I gave many lectures at PI on that, so you are all encouraged to have a look if you want to learn more about another very interesting aspect of n equals 4, which shows that n equals 4 is very special. Not only this. Yes?
So those gluon scattering amplitudes, are those Suzy gluons?
No, just gluons. Usual gluons. But in n equals 4, premiums, but they are really gluons. Right, so. I must really emphasize this is in n equals 4 supreme. Okay. No one asked me how could someone come up with this idea? It was kind of crazy. How could someone, okay, it's the same data, how come? Why? But for example, what would you do to compute this guy in string theory? In ADS-CFT, a strong coupling. You compute a surface which ends on this polygon in ADS. Right? And then there is a very important symmetry of ADS, a very important transformation that you can do in string theory, which is called T-duality, which you studied. And T-duality maps a surface into some other surface. Now, what the Lyon Modestina did was, okay, they had, suppose you have this computation of the Wilson loop, and you have some surface. Do the duality and see what you get. And what you get is a surface which looks like the surface that you would draw to compute a scattering amplitude. And then, wow, at least that strong coupling, the two guys are the same. Maybe they are always the same. And then people went and computed that with coupling, one loop, two loops, three loops, and it works. So it was one of those cases where ZDSFT was extremely important as inspiration to tell if you believe ZDSFT, try to check if these objects are the same, because that's from coupling they should be. And indeed, it started a huge line of research where people are trying to compute this at weak coupling, at strong coupling, and so on. Okay, very good. So,
who came up with the idea?
Of doing this T-duality? Aldai and Modestina. This was 2007. Okay. So this is one way of making stuff more finite. The second way is obtained by defining loops in n equals 4 superimages. Okay? So, to define these loops in n equals 4 superimages, maybe I need to tell you what n equals 4 superimages is. I'm not sure how. How much were you told about n equals 4 supreme means? What's the action? Does someone know what the action? No? The action was written, no?
Yeah, and Freddy wrote it down. We didn't really use it much last week.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's have a brief reminder of n equals 4 supreme means. Maybe it's just. Even though, okay. So n equals 4 supreme means. Is a dimensional reduction of 10 dimensional n equals 1 superimages to 4 dimensional. So this guy, this 10 dimensional equivalent, is equal to the action is just you have some integral over 10 dimensions, and then you have trace. They are matrices, it's non abelian. F, M, N. I'm using this capital letter for letters that are in 10 dimensions. F, M, N. Plus some spinner, psi, D slash sorry. Okay? And then you say that the fields only depend on four dimensions, not on the six. You get rid of the six dimensions and you get n equals four superimages. Okay? Is this okay? So we say that any field phi naively will depend on x, which is four dimensions, and on y, which will be six dimensions. We say that it doesn't depend on y. Here, we go four dimensions, we get the x of n equals four. I guess it's better if I say some more words about this. No? It might. So, let's first, I first want to be absolutely sure that people understand what the indices are, what this stuff is. For example, what do I mean by trace of psi d slash psi? Let's write this with all the indices, okay? Kind of painful to write something beautiful or something ugly, but okay. Let's do it, let's write it at all the indices. So, first I need space, let me see. I even write sums, I even don't put summation implicit. You see, to write this with indices, I need five sums. So, what is this? Okay, let's write this completely explicit. There is a psi. A spinner, okay, which has a spinner index. Okay, let me write first the full object. Then there is the d slash, which is gamma, contracted with derivative, which can act on psi. Plus I, then there is commutator of the gauge field, A, with psi. Okay, so let's see the indices. Okay, first, this derivative and this A, they have some index, M, some space-time, 10-dimensional space-time index. Where do I contract it with? I just want to be sure that people understand this notation. With a gamma, right? Where else would it be? So this contracts with a gamma, right here. What else? Now, the gamma is a matrix, right? The gamma matrix, it has indices, A, B. Who else should have indices A, B? Size, right? A, some index B. An index B. What else? What else? What indices am I still missing? Gauge indices. These guys are matrices, right? There is a trace. They are n by n matrices. So then these guys are furthermore matrices. They have some index B. Okay? And all this stuff has some index BA. Why BA and not BC? If I'm multiplying two matrices, because I'm taking the trace. So this C will be A. Okay? And now, even to be completely sure, let's write what this means. So A runs from 1 up to what? A, which is the gauge index, runs from N, right? It's SUN. B, N. M. Sorry? 0 to? 0 to 9. Good. 10 dimensions. A and B. Okay, this one is less legal here. So A runs from 1 to 16, B runs from 1 to 16. A component of this. Okay? Very good. So, very good. Now the idea is now we drop the dependence on x4, x5, x6, 7, next 8, and next 9 to go down to n equals 4. Let me remind you how this works. For example, what we then do, if we are going to treat these guys separately, it's better to say that am, let's separate this into the first indices, the first three indices, a mu, where this guy runs from 0 to 3, and then the other ones, let's call it phi I, where this I is runs from 1 to 6. Okay, I could put it run from 4 to 9, but okay, doesn't matter. Just convention. Because we are going to separate these two guys. Am I repeating stuff that you did already? Did you do this stuff before? Okay. So now, for example, what is fmn squared? Okay, this is equal to f mu nu, where this mu nu now are related to the a mu and a mu, right? The usual f for the gauge guy. Then, what happens if one index is mu and the other index is I? Well, if one index is mu and the other index is I, inside the f, sometimes you have derivative with respect to I. But nothing depends on I, because as I said, I drop the dependence on those guys. So what happens is that I don't get field strength for the other guys. What I get, let me write, and I think it will be completely clear. We get d mu phi I, d mu phi I. This is what would come from the term where you use mu and I index. Okay, you don't get derivative with respect to I, because we say explicitly that we drop dependence on derivative respect to I. So you get something like this, okay? Plus, what happens if we choose the two indices to be I and J? I and J, what do we keep out of the F squared? The commutator, because anything with derivatives we drop. Plus, commutator out phi I phi J times commutator of phi I phi J. Okay, good. Very good. These gamma matrices, these are 10-dimensional sigma matrices, which obey gamma m, plus gamma m, gamma n, equal to eta m. Similarly, so this is the first guy that we needed. The second guy that we needed, so that's half of the action that we are done. Then we need what is psi, this slash psi. Well, again, this is equal to psi. Now, the spinner index I don't write. But then we have gamma mu, okay, d mu psi plus commutator of a mu with psi. This is if I choose the index m there to be a space-time index. What if I choose it to be an I index, which I will ignore? Then I don't have the derivative, and I have the commutator. Plus psi gamma I phi I psi. Okay. So you know now what the action of n equals 4 is. It's these two lines. Let me write that this is PCD, but I put a smile. It's understood that I'm joking. But it's true. It's true in some sense that this is indeed a theory which doesn't seem like so bad for a term all over QCD. Yeah. There's QCD there. plus stuff. It looks even more complicated, like you see. But it's not. Of course, it's simpler because we have so much synergy. Okay, good. And now, our one idea that we can try to do is to construct a loop in 10 dimensions and see what happens when I would reduce it to 4 dimensions. So I could say that some natural loops in n plus 4 are 10-dimensional loops. These are some natural observables in n equals 4, because n equals 4 is so directly related to a theory in 10 dimensions, that is the low-lying energy of open string, that it's very natural to consider 10-dimensional loops, where I have in the exponent some integral of x dot m times some am, which is equal to some integral I split now. The Lagrangian of n equals 4 supernumeraries, or the action is integral d for x of the Lagrangian, which is integral d for x a plus b, where this stuff is a, this stuff is b.
But
the left, the right hand side.
So if you integrate over those terms that
all, all fields here are fields which only depend on x mu. You see, there are no derivatives with respect to I. That was the point. When we wrote here, okay, maybe you don't want an equal sign. Maybe you want an arrow to indicate that we reduced. So any derivative with respect to I we killed. And then you want to put the equal A here. Does it make you happy? So I have something. I dimensionally reduce. It becomes this, and this is this. Okay. So I'm saying, for example, there is no di. Here there will be di gamma I. Di I dropped from the second line. Big Y, because the fermion only depends on x mu.
Did you drop the di by integrating over it? Or?
No, I dropped by just saying that the fields are, in a way, in a zero mode of those dimensions. Don't depend on those dimensions. If you want, this is just a mnemonic. Whenever I forget something about n equals 4, I mean, it's easier to memorize s squared plus psi d psi than to memorize all the stuff on the right-hand side. It's just, we can start with this. And actually, this is what we are studying. Just now I will write some loop that if you did not know that it came from 10 dimensions, it would look kind of crazy. How would you guess such objects? But when you remember that there is a nice 10-dimensional description, it's a very natural object. So this guy, when I contract, there is this stuff, plus the loop in the other space, y dot I, phi I. Okay? Which depends on the point x. Okay? So look what I'm doing. So the loop moves in this loop is some x of t, y of t. But the fields only depend on x of t and dimensionally reduced. Okay? So normally I would put here x and y, here x and y, but now I put only x because I dimensionally reduced. So if x dot squared plus y dot squared equal to 0, that would be cool. Let me write. Why? Because then we are describing a curve, which is null, always. And therefore it's finite. Okay? From this point of view, it is clear. I'm just describing some curve where this total xm squared is equal to 0. Okay? this will be some finite quantity. Typically it's hard to do because you are summing two positive things. It's hard to get zero. But what you can do is you can complexify. And you can say that y is I, y, and then the two fight against each other and you can get non-trivial zeros. Okay? So what we do is we say that y dot is equal to I times a function theta I at t such that theta I square equals 1, theta I equals 1, times absolute value of x dot. This, for example, does the job. And this I is important. This I is square root of minus 1, of course. This I is important to get y dot square equal to 1. All this is not derivation or anything. This is motivation. And the motivation, after all this motivation, we conclude that the nice object to define in any of course brand meals is, now I'm defining it, the Wilson loop in n equals 4 for a given curve C can be defined, okay, this depends, the Wilson loop in n equals 4 is given by the path order exponential of the integral of a mu x dot mu plus I phi I theta I absolute value of x dot d. This is definition. Okay? Where this theta is equal to 1. And more than that, it could in principle change with time, but let's, for simplicity, let's only consider theta I equals, say, 1, 0, 0. This is just for simplicity. Do I want to do it? Yes. So that it doesn't just a constant. Okay, good. This was just the motivation for defining this object. Okay, very good. Now let's forget the motivation and find something and be surprised, which if we keep in mind the motivation, it's obvious, but now the goal is to forget the motivation and be happy. Namely, let's see that it's finite. I mean, of course it's finite, we checked, but I want to do it again. Okay? So, and basically it's this object that the prescription that you will compute in the afternoon computes. So it's this guy that you will be computing. Okay? It's this supersymmetric Wilson. The standard dimensions are very natural. You have the brains where n equals 4 is defined, and you have degrees of freedom on the brain, and you put this heavy particle, which is the Wilson loop, and the particle can push on the brain as well, and this is what this coupling to the scalars is describing. The fact that the particle which is going on the loop is also pushing the brain, pulling the brain. Okay, but let's then see what happens. So in four dimensions, now we take that definition. Why is this finite? Because now we know what the answer is. From four dimensions, it looks like a cancellation of diagrams. From four dimensions, what happens is that you would say that this diagram is divergent, but it cancels with this diagram, where this is a scalar, and this is a gluon. And this is equal to finite. Right? Let's just see in more detail. What is this? What's the first guy? The first guy is integral, so we have double integral, right? dt1, dt2, and then we brought down to this guy, so we get x dot of t1 dot x dot of t2. X dot of t1 dot x dot of t2 over the distance squared. So this is what we are tired of doing. Okay, what about the other one? We bring down two of these guys, right? So the other one is plus, let's do the other one in more detail, I squared from bringing down two of those guys. And then we have the integral absolute value of x dot at point t1 from one of the guys, absolute value of x dot at point t2, and then the propagator of two scalars, which is 1 over x of t1 minus x of t2 squared. This is nothing but the average of phi scalar 1 at x of t1 with scalar 1 at x of t2.
Propagate.
Okay? In other words, we get that this is just a double integral. Okay? dt1, dt2. Let's put just everything on the same fraction. We have x of t1 minus x of t2 squared, and then we have x dot of t1 dot x dot of t2 minus absolute value of x dot of t1 absolute value of x dot of t2. When t1 approaches t2, this becomes absolute value of x dot squared, and this becomes absolute value of x dot squared. And they cancel, and they give a finite value. Do you get it? You see? It becomes very finite. Again, x dot squared minus x dot of x dot, which is x dot squared. So when t1 is approaching t2, this is finite. Okay? Nothing surprising. We are just redoing in four dimensions what we know how to work from 10-dimensional point of view. But if someone would give you this object, you will be very happy. This is the first thing you will do and say, wow, it's finite. So cool. Okay. Very good. So maybe it's a good point to stop or not. I stop? Yeah, why not? So what we will do next time is do something which might seem completely surprising. How can we be able to do it? We will compute this Wilson law in this non-abelian gauge theory for a circle. Exactly. That's it. Okay, see you tomorrow. We are going for lunch now.